This is Backstory, the show that turns to history to understand the world around us today. I'm your 18th century host, Peter Onuf.
I'm your 19th century host, Ed Ayers.
And I'm your 20th century host, Brian Bellow. Today on the show, we're looking at the story of public education in America and asking whether people have always worried about schools as much as they seem to worry today.
We're going to take another call now. This one is from John in Monina, Virginia. John, welcome to Backstory.
Hi, guys. How y'all doing?
Well, we're doing great.
Well, my question is, when I think about the old one-room schoolhouse with the school marm who was paid by the parents of the students, when and why and how did we move from that consumer-based model to our current more socialized model? Now we're funding this big, giant school system as opposed to saying, okay, we're watching the children go up to the one-room schoolhouse, making sure they come out smarter, and then paying for that.
Yeah, I think what you're getting at, John, is the levels between us and the education of our kids or other people's kids, it's so distant, we don't really feel that we have much control over it. Though you have to say that the survival of PTAs and school boards that are responsive to local citizens, they keep alive that historic memory of having control over our children's education and over the way we govern ourselves.
As has homeschooling, which has become popular recently. But, you know, I want to address the elephant in the room, the B word, because I think it goes to the heart of John's question, and that's bureaucracy.
Yeah.
And I think what John, you tell me, John, but what you're really talking about is getting away from kind of direct parent control and handing over control of education to, in essence, all of these middle men. And the funny thing is that all these superintendents, et cetera, stuff were men, and all the lower paid teachers were women as this transition took place in the late 19th and early 20th century. Am I on the right track there, John? Is this what's really got you troubled?
Right. It was, when did the states decide the localities weren't very good at it and needed to get involved? And then when did the federal government decide the states weren't very good at it and they needed to get involved? And it's done exactly as you said. It's created this huge bureaucracy. The amount of money we spend educating our children in the public sector is much more than private schools spend to educate a child. And it's not because the teachers are so overpaid or because they have really, you know, fantastic books. It's because we have these bureaucracies. We have all these upper-level administrative people that we're paying. And it's consuming a lot of the funds that should be either going to education or not be collected in the first place.
Thank goodness you didn't ask that question, John, because that it would have required actual historical knowledge to answer it. But I'll take a crack at it anyway. Basically, the states got involved in the late 19th century and early 20th century. And by the 1920s and 1930s, it was the states that started saying, hey, it's not cost efficient to have all of these little one-room schools all over the place. We're going to build consolidated schools. And of course, at the same time, states were building roads, so it was easier to get to these schools. It was easier to run school buses by the 30s and the 40s. When did the federal government get involved? Well, you'd have to point to the very important Education Act in 1965, passed by Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society. And, you know, that was aimed at poor kids. And where were most of the poor kids? They were in the South.
Yep.
And a very funny thing happened on the way to the schoolhouse. States that were determined not to integrate, Southern states, started accepting this federal money. And along with money comes control. And the federal government said, hey, you know, we're not going to fund segregated schools. And if you don't integrate, this is separate from Brown v. Board of Education, separate from the courts. The federal government said, you know, if you don't integrate, we're going to cut off all that money. And you know what? Those states said, God, we're getting so much federal money, we can't even think of not accepting it. We better move towards integration. The last thing I'll say, John, in answer to your question is none of us like bureaucrats. Bureaucrat itself is kind of a pejorative term. And of course, you can find examples of excess. But I think that overall, these bureaucrats have really been pretty impressive at raising the standards of American education at the same time that they have helped bring in virtually all kids to the education system. It is not easy to educate everybody and educate them well. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox now.
It's never too late in America, and that distinguishes the American educational system from every other educational system in the world. And it's never too late to learn something about history if you keep tuned to Backstory. That's what we're here for. This is kind of a remedial education for grown-ups.
I truly appreciate the education that you have just given me, which is, you know, that you
are you calling me a bureaucrat?
No, a teacher.
Thanks so much for calling, John.
Well, I feel a lot smarter. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, John.
Yeah, take care.
So, Brian, you mentioned that school funding from the federal government helped lead to desegregation in the late 60s.
Right.
I think it's important to remember, though, that the big case that led to desegregation, Brown versus Board of Education, occurred back in 1954. So there's a whole missing decade in between. Now, what happened was this. Southern politicians, led by Virginia Senator Harry Byrd, basically said, "We don't care what you say, we're not going to integrate." It was a movement that came to be known as massive resistance. In 1958, the governor actually closed down the white schools in three Virginia cities so they wouldn't have to integrate them.
Yeah, and one of those cities was our own Charlottesville.
Yeah, and one of the students who graduated from Charlottesville's black high school that year was Alicia Lugo. And we're going to hear her story in just a minute. But first, let me give you a little background on her. Alicia Lugo went off to college, got her teaching degree, and came back to Charlottesville. She was assigned to teach in the same school where she had been a student. Now, this was 1965, but even though segregation had officially been outlawed, the student body there was still all black. 2 years later, the city closed that school and moved her over to Walker School, integrated finally after all those years. Years later, she went on to chair the city school board for more than a decade. Now, I'm going to shut up and play for you guys my recent conversation with Ms. Alicia Lugo.
I was born in Charlottesville. All my public school education was here in Charlottesville, first at all-black Jefferson Elementary School and then all-black Burleigh High School, which was an excellent school. I think that people have some erroneous feeling that because we had fewer supplies and less resources and our teachers were fighting over one film projector and that sort of thing, that we were somehow receiving an inferior education. I find that laughable from the standpoint of 50, 60 years later.
Did people not resent, though, the fact that they might have multiple film projectors and better supplies and things at Lane?
Well, projectors and supplies don't make the excellent educational experience. You have to make a child want to learn, and that's what we came up under. To my way of thinking, having been a student at all black Burleigh, feeling safe, knowing that there was a definite connection between my home and my teachers, my parents were intricately involved. In fact, many more black parents than now were supportive of both our teachers and our schools, and Burleigh students excelled everywhere.
Why do you think that so many people then would work through the courts and sacrifice so much in order to bring about integration of the schools?
Because they recognize that there is no such thing as separate but equal, that for many minority children, the segregated school system was a farce. When children had to walk 2 miles past an available school to go to school, those things were jokes. But even though the separate but equal schools were crushed by the courts, if you walk down the halls of an average school today, you'll see situations where classes are either all black, Hispanic, and poor white, and other classes that are all white with perhaps a token black person or Asian person in there.
So why do you think that integration did not turn out the way that people dreamed of?
because I think that there were those people who had no intention of letting it turn out that way.
Mm-hmm.
The only way systems change is that you treat them like a rubber band. As long as you keep the tension on the rubber band, you can change its shape. But once you let go that tension, once you let go that scrutiny, it drops right back into its original form.
That's a great metaphor. May I steal that?
I like sure that. Sure you can.
So it's your sense that the tension left the schools when there was not really a direct connection between the teachers in their community and the students in their community? Is that what happened?
Exactly. And the scrutiny was gone because who can complain? Now we have the desegregated schools, so you got what you asked for. But we've got in Charlottesville a majority African-American school board. We have an African-American female superintendent, an African-American assistant superintendent, female, and we have a 13% dropout rate. What's wrong with that picture?
And what do you think is wrong with that? What's driving that?
Well, I guess to my way of thinking, when school is not interesting, when you don't see any relationship between school and your future, when you feel you're in a hostile environment, when you feel that you're not safe in that environment, when you feel that people don't have the level of expectations for your performance that they do for other students' performances, school doesn't seem to make much sense, does it?
No, I understand what you're saying. If we can go back to your story a little bit, it makes me wonder, you know, when I think about what great changes that you saw and experienced and helped lead, did we lose a generation or did we lose some continuity or some tradition of our teachers that people said, look, this is just so ridiculous if the state's going to be playing games like with massive resistance and, you know, if they're not going to be really giving every kid a chance instead of doing this tracking and so forth, that did people just become disgusted and said, look, I'll just put my energies in something else?
Which is exactly what I did. I stayed at Walker 1 year, and I realized that numbers of minority children dropping out of school, getting pushed out of school, somebody needed to be out there to help reclaim them. And so for the next 35 years, I worked in nonprofits that worked with kids, trying to help them get themselves on track.
Well, I'm really grateful for your time today and your insight and a couple of metaphors I'm going to steal, but also very grateful for keeping the faith over all these years and doing the very best that you can with whatever history's handed you. So thank you so very much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
That's Alicia Lugo, former teacher and school board chair right here in Charlottesville, Virginia.
It's a slow, slow train, but it's moving on.
You know, there's a deep irony in that interview that Ed teased out, which is that at the very moment when real opportunities were opening up for African Americans in society, Ms. Lugo seems to suggest that teachers were giving up on students and students were giving up on school. How can that be? I know this is my century, but I don't have the answers to that.
Yeah. Well, Brian, I think that was what was so upsetting to me about this interview, that sense that you won the big struggle, you thought, over integration, but there's a bigger struggle over what we now call racism.
Yeah, and that's the fundamental tension or tragedy in the heart of all of this. On one hand, you can't just say we're going to have separate but equal, because obviously they show that separate but equal doesn't work. On the other hand, when you do that, you insert several layers of necessary bureaucracy between parents and students in the schools. And I'm not exactly sure, well, we do know what happens, is that some people spend the money to create little schools over which they have control, which are little private schools, and Charlottesville mm-hmm. has a number of those itself right now, which yeah. are dedicated to young women or dedicated to people of different religious backgrounds. And so I don't know if that's segregation. Matter of fact, it's not. It's a trivialization of that word to talk about people looking for various kinds of affinities. But I think that what Ms. Lugo would say is that real integration was never given a chance, and that economic inequalities yeah. were inserted right. in place of racial inequalities. And as a result, right. we have a sham.
Yeah, I think the point is that community, which we get nostalgic about, is a double-edged sword. That is, on the one hand, of course, in many ways, that's what we strive for, a sense of identification with each other, of nurture and care. Yet communities are also inevitably throughout history exclusive, and they want to define themselves according to their own image, or that is, according to the group that dominates within that community. So it's a highly volatile situation, and I think maybe the only upbeat message of all this is there have been such massive dislocations that maybe a new sense of community will emerge out of all this, which will at least move forward in terms of our expectations of our students. Who's going to succeed? And there's some reason to hope that we can overcome that self-perpetuating notion of discrimination and superiority and racism.
Well, and I don't think we should underestimate the importance of daily contact and interaction within the schools. Yes, there may be tracking within certain classes, but I don't think we should underestimate the interaction between racial groups starting in kindergarten.
Yeah, yeah.
Even if those relations are not smooth or, you know, out of Disneyland at all times.
Yeah, well, Brian, I think what we got here is an example of schools which we expect to take the lead in social change.
Right.
But in many ways, social change is going to register last in schools. I mean, it's a real paradox.
Those are all really good points. I guess, you know, looking at it from the viewpoint of history, which may that be a great idea for a radio show.
Yeah, let's do it.
I'm struck that we've had 300 years, almost 400 years, of slavery and injustice. And I wouldn't want us to despair too soon when we're only 25 years into a new, yeah. more expansive, inclusive order. There's no doubt that what Ms. Lugo said is true, but if we lose faith that we can make that change, we've lost faith in America.
Ed, I think that's a good way to sum up, and it's a good thing, too, because that's all the time we have for today. But remember, we want to keep the conversation going. Visit us online and tell us what you think about the past, present, and future of public education in America.
You can find us at backstoryradio.org. Don't be a stranger. Thanks for listening.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore, with help from Bart Elmore and Lydia Wilson. Special thanks today to David Barringer.
Jamal Milner mastered the show, and Gabi Alter wrote our theme. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major production support for Backstory with American History Guys is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the University of Richmond, Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs, and an anonymous donor.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for VFH Radio at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.